Drugs can be bad, but can drug prohibition be worse? Where and when did sobriety become a virtue? And is compassion a cure? Through an opening in societal conversation, the sex drive was rescued from the subconscious and our shame. Now, it's the intoxication drive that's being called into conversation with Johann Hari's book, Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. And what he found, I hope, will have all of us in a compassionate conversation. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Johann, were you surprised to discover the drug war started as a race war, or is that the reason why you went after this?
I was totally surprised. You know, I started working on this book 4 years ago because I realized we were coming up to 100 years since drugs were first banned. And I thought I knew quite a lot about this subject. I've always cared about it because we had addiction in my family. One of my earliest memories is of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And as I got older, realizing why. And then we had other people who became addicts in my family and other people very close to me. And I kind of had a list in my head of questions that I wanted to know the answer to. Why were drugs banned in the first place? Why do we continue with this war on users and addicts when it doesn't seem to be working? What are the alternatives in practice? And what really causes drug use and drug addiction? And what really struck me is I couldn't find the answers by reading. I was looking in lots of places. And a lot of the discussion, not all of it, but a lot of it seemed to be very abstract, as if we were at a philosophy seminar. And I didn't want to do that. So I decided to go on this journey that ended up taking me across 30,000 miles in nine countries. And I wanted to really just sit with people whose lives had been transformed by this policy one way or another, and talk to them and listen to them and then relate them to the bigger picture. So it ended up taking me to some really fascinating people, from a transsexual crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, to a scientist who spends a lot of time feeding hallucinogens to mongooses to see what would happen, to the only country that's ever decriminalized all drugs from cannabis to crack, with really startling results. And you're totally right, of the many things I discovered that I didn't know at the start, one was that the drug war began in totally different circumstances to the ones I would have imagined. If you'd said to me when I started the journey, why were drugs banned, I would have guessed that the reason was the reason that anyone would give if we stopped them randomly in the street and asked why drugs are banned now. We don't want kids to use drugs, we don't want people to become addicted, and so on. Actually, going back and looking at the archives of the people who launched the drug war, that's not what was going on at all. And I tell the story in the book of how this all began through the story of Billie Holiday and how she was stalked and killed by the man who launched the war on drugs. Yeah, in 1939, Billie Holiday stands on stage in New York City and she sings the song Strange Fruit, which your listeners will know is a song about lynching, a song against lynching. It's incredibly shocking to have an African-American woman standing in front of a white audience singing a song like that. She wasn't even allowed to walk through the front door of that hotel. She had to go through the service elevator. And that night, she got a warning from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics to stop singing that song. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was run by probably the most influential person who no one's ever heard of, a man called Harry Anslinger, who invented the modern drug war. And he was really driven by two things: an intense hatred of addicts and an intense hatred of African Americans. At the same time, he found out Billie Holiday was an addict. He found out Judy Garland was an addict. He told her to take longer vacations and reassured the studio that she was going to be fine. But with Billie Holiday, who was African American, he resolves to destroy her. She had promised herself as a little girl growing up in segregated Baltimore that she would never bow her head to any white man. And so she basically told them to go and screw themselves, that she was going to carry on singing the song. He has her stalked. He has her sent to prison. He has her destroyed. Perhaps the cruelest thing is when she gets out of prison, she can barely perform anywhere because you needed a license to perform anywhere where alcohol was served and he had it denied to her. She, of course, relapses back into addiction in that situation. She ends up getting very sick. She's taken to hospital. When she's taken to hospital, she said to one of her friends, "They're going to kill me in there. Don't let them," talking about the federal agents. She was diagnosed with liver cancer. They arrested her on her deathbed, these men. They didn't let her friends in to see her. They took away her record player. One of her friends managed to insist that she was given methadone because she was in withdrawal. She started to recover. Then they cut off the methadone and she died. And there's loads of things, I think, just very quickly about the what we can learn from that story. One is, this is what we do to addicts all over the United States and in most of the world. We cut them off from their sources of meaning. We take people who are suffering. You know, Billie Holiday was raped as a little girl. She had an unbearable life, prostituted as a little girl. She was trying to deal with her pain. We take people who are in agony, addicts because they're in agony and can't bear to be present in their lives, and then we inflict more pain on them and we think they'll stop. But the other element is exactly what you referred to about race, and those figures run right through to today. African Americans are no more likely to be drug users or drug addicts than anyone else. They make up the overwhelming majority of people who go to prison for it.
And that is, that's a very political issue as well, as we know in this day and time. And it's political in the other sense that white people oftentimes have the money or the wherewithal, or I know so-and-so, to just get off, whereas many blacks don't have that possibility, I guess.
Yeah, you're totally right. I quote in the book a speech by a guy called Matthew Fogg, who was a cop in D.C. And one day he went to his boss and said something like, "Hey, boss, how come we only ever go to the black neighborhoods to do drug arrests? How come I'm pretty sure white people use drugs?" And his boss, the exact words are in the book, his boss said something like, "Well, you're damn right, but white people get lawyers and white people know judges and journalists. So, you know, we go for the low-hanging fruit." And it's important to understand some of this is clearly conscious racism, and we've seen in what's happened in Ferguson and some of the stuff that's emerged, really conscious racism. Some of it is really not. If you've got a law that's broken by half of the population, as the drug laws have been, you know, you can't arrest half of the population of the United States. What are you going to do? You're inevitably going to go after the people who are easiest to arrest and least able to fight back. So even when the individuals aren't racist, the effect is racist.
Yes, and it's like stopping cars on a certain day. They have to give out X amount of tickets. There are numbers that they need to keep up with, and this is how it gets done. I'm sure it was very well intended, because especially now hearing you speak, when you humanize the addicts and prisoners in your book, it's such a compelling story, and I feel like you are a living testament to compassion, and I'm sure writing this book made you even more so. But you know, it was annoying, I have to say, at one point where I thought, okay, well, I just have X amount of time to read your book right now, so I'm just going to skim through this. But it was like, it was impossible. It's like, no, I have to find out what happened to this person. You really make someone care. So I think as a book, if that was your desire, you very much accomplished it.
Oh, I really appreciate you saying that. You know, I think part of what's happened, part of why the drug war can continue, is because we've dehumanized the people at its heart, whether they are drug dealers, drug addicts, cops. And I think a large part of the job, my book isn't really a book of argument, a large part of the job is about rehumanizing the people at the heart of this war. Because if we really, I really felt I met so many amazing people from Chino Hardin, a transsexual crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, who was conceived when his mother, who was a crack addict, was raped by his dad, who was an NYPD officer, to the president of Uruguay, Jose Mujica, who was kept at the bottom of a well for 4 years by the dictatorship and emerges to become elected president and end the drug war in his country. I just felt like, in a way, when I wanted to talk to people, I didn't want to argue with them about the drug war. I don't think that's very interesting. I wanted to introduce them to these people. I wanted them to feel they'd met them. Because I feel like if people had met Chino, if they'd met Lee Maddox, this incredible cop in Baltimore who was honest enough to see the racism of it and to fight against the drug war, or Bud Osborne, who was a homeless street addict in Vancouver who started an uprising in his city that has completely transformed Canada, I kind of thought, that's the way this war will end. And it was very personal to me because, of course, I had loved addicts all my life. As we said, it was in my family. So I didn't find it difficult to see addicts as human, although it kind of helped me as well, because anyone who's got addicts in their life, and people listening to this will have, if we're honest, you know, I've always been in favour of more compassionate drug policies, but particularly when I set out, there was a really big part of me that was really angry with the addicts in my life. And I think one of the reasons why the debate about the drug war is so charged is because it runs through everyone's heart. We all have a bit of us that's very compassionate, and we all have a bit of us that just looks at the addicts we love and thinks, I wish someone would just stop you. And in a way, this journey really helped me getting to know these people and seeing the heroism of so many addicts really helped me. You know, like one of Billie Holiday's friends, Annie Ross, who's a brilliant jazz singer, said to me, Billie Holiday wasn't weak. Billie Holiday was as strong as she could be. And that really helped me to think about the addicts in my life, because in the story of Billie Holiday, there's this terrible story of this person being persecuted and destroyed. But there's also an incredible story of courage and resistance. You know, no matter what they did to her, she always found somewhere to sing that song. She always found somewhere. She would go to the South and she would sing about lynching, you know, even when it was really dangerous to do that. And to know there's a kind of everyday heroism of addicts, of just carrying on when you're in terrible pain. And then there's the heroism of, you know, while we're speaking all over the world, people are listening to Billie Holiday and feeling stronger. And what an achievement that someone who was in such pain was able to do that. And then, of course, the other really enlivening thing about doing the book was to go to the places where they've moved beyond the drug war and see how incredibly well all that works, and to learn about what really causes addiction, which was something that I just didn't know before I went into this, and I think most people don't know, and it's fascinating as well.
Yes, well, we're hopefully going to move into a lot more of this as we go along. Plato Oplomo rang through every level of the drug story, and I'm wondering if you would share an initial story about that and how it did run all the way through to the top of government.
Yeah, Plato Oplomo is the threat that the cartels make in northern Mexico, where I went, and it basically means silver or lead. It means take a bribe from us or take a bullet from us. So you can either work for us or we'll kill you. And this goes right from the start of the drug war. It's really interesting. Right at the birth of... When you ban drugs, as happened 100 years ago, they don't disappear. You don't pull a lever and they vanish. What happens is they're transferred from the people who used to control them, who are pharmacists and doctors, to armed criminal gangs. And those armed criminal gangs work very differently to pharmacists and doctors. The best way to explain it is if you and me go into our local, where you know, in Colorado near where you are, if you go into your local liquor store and try to steal the beer or vodka, they'll just call the cops and cops will take you away. So that liquor store doesn't need to be violent or intimidating. If you go up to your local drug dealer and try to steal his drugs, obviously he can't ring the cops. The cops will arrest him. So he has to be violent and intimidating in order to protect his property. You don't want to be having a fight every day, so you want to establish a reputation for being so terrifying that no one will dare to mess with you. And you see that right at the birth of the drug war. I tell the story of Arnold Rothstein, a gangster in New York City who invented modern drug dealing. And the place where I saw it most was when I went to northern Mexico and then to Texas to interview. I interviewed this guy called Rosario Retta, who is the only person to ever be at the heart of the deadliest Mexican drug cartel, the Zetas, and live to tell get out and live to tell the story of what life is like inside that cartel. Rosario grew up in Laredo, which is on the Mexico-Texas border on the American side, and he was recruited at the age of 13 to work for the Zetas, and between the age of 13 and 17, he killed about 70 people by beheading, unimaginably horrific murders. And I went to interview him in prison in Texas, and I tell his story in Chasing the Scream, and it was so fascinating. I kind of shocked some people recently by saying that of all the people I interviewed, he was the one I felt most sorry for, which may sound odd because there are much more admirable people in my book than him, but you know, this is a guy, he's going to spend the whole of the rest of his life in solitary confinement because whenever he gets out, he gets immediately stabbed because people know they'll get loads of money for doing it. But Rosalia's story, I think, really helps us to understand the dynamics behind the drug war and how it works. You know, Rosalia used to go out to kill these people and the Mexican police would be with him to help them. The Mexican, what you've got, the situation, if you think about a housing project in the U.S. where 5 to 10% of the economy of that housing project is in the hands of armed criminal gangs selling drugs, that housing project will be a terrible place to be. What you're talking about in Ciudad Juarez, for example, is 70% of the economy is controlled by these armed criminal gangs in the drug trade. That means that the armed criminal gangs can outbid the state. They have more money than the government. So the whole, they'll basically take over the government. This is what happened in New York City in the 20s with Arnold Rothstein. He just had more money than the police. So the NYPD, you know, there's a quote, a journalist at the time, he said that, you know, the NYPD officers were more scared of him than they were of the NYPD commissioner. And the same thing is true in Mexico today. And the scale of the horror, I mean, I looked at lots of disturbing things from my book, but what we have done to the supply route countries with the drug war is off the scale. I mean, Michelle Leonhardt, the head of the Drug Enforcement Agency, you know, a person whose wages you pay as an American taxpayer, was asked about the 60,000 Mexican civilians who've died in the last 7 years. And she said, these are her exact words, that it was a sign of success in the war on drugs. And I saw what that means in practice. And that should be a national scandal that someone whose wages you pay said that.
Yes, of course. And all of this really does point to how prohibition creates crime. As you mentioned in your book, arresting a rapist means that rapes will go down, but arresting a drug king, not only do not the drugs go down, but then there's an increase in crime until the new boss is crowned.
Exactly. The drug war creates several layers of crime. And one of the best ways to understand this is to look at both the beginning of the drug war and the end of the drug war. Because I tell the story in the book of a doctor called Henry Smith Williams, who in California, who treated patients when drugs were legal and then after drugs were banned. And he was not a liberal and not very sympathetic to addicts, but he noticed something really striking, which is when drugs were legal, the vast majority, and there was government research, U.S. government research that showed this. Obviously, being an addict is always problematic, just like being an alcoholic is always problematic. The vast majority of addicts had jobs. They were no more likely to be criminal than anyone else, and they were no more likely to be poor than anyone else. When drugs are banned, they were immediately transferred to these criminal gangs. These criminal gangs immediately jack up the price by, literally, I think the figure was 1,000%. Suddenly, addicts who previously could afford to get their drugs from the local pharmacy and didn't have particular problems are pushed into either prostitution if they're women, property crime if they're men. There's the dynamic, which is the drug gangs fighting out amongst themselves to establish control of their patch, which causes lots of killing. Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, calculated there's 10,000 extra murders every year in the United States as a result of that dynamic. And there's all the addicts suddenly pushed into crime. So you get this double way. One of the other ways we know about how this creates crime is we can look at what happens when you legalize, and we can see this in Switzerland, for example. Switzerland, which is a very conservative country, has legalized heroin for addicts. Which means, and I went there and saw how this works, it means that if you're a heroin addict, you go to the doctor. The doctor will assign you to a clinic. You go to the clinic, you get your heroin there, you use it there. You're not allowed to take it out. And what happens there? There's no violent heroin drug dealing anymore. It doesn't exist because people get it from the doctor. There have been zero deaths from heroin overdoses in those clinics. None, not a single one. It's been running for 20 years now. And the vast majority of the heroin addicts there have jobs, get their lives back together, the chaos of street use ends. So it was really fascinating to learn about this kind of at both ends, if you like, because that's how you really see how the dynamic works and what the difference that's made by the drug war is. And it made it all the more heartbreaking to then go and see these totally unnecessary tragedies. I went in Arizona and went out with chain gangs of women who are forced to go out, literally chained to each other, wearing T-shirts saying, I was a drug addict, and forced to dig graves. And I mean, it was just, yeah, it was a very difficult experience to see these women being brutalized and humiliated, and exactly what we did to Billie Holiday. You know, when they get out, they're never going to get jobs again, their lives are ruined. And the idea that that would mean they'd be more likely to get their lives together and get clean is just bizarre to me.
Yes, what numbers did they have in Switzerland, for instance, regarding, I'm sure a big question of the normal citizen would be, well, didn't the numbers go up of people that wanted to go get free heroin?
This is fascinating. Actually, there was the best stats, best research on this was actually with a different heroin prescription program in Liverpool, where something that no one anticipated happened. So in Liverpool, before they did this in Switzerland, in Liverpool in the north of England, actually just outside Liverpool, a place called the Wirral, they had a big experiment with heroin prescription, where they prescribed heroin to addicts. And there were basically two things that people thought might happen. Some people thought there'd be exactly what you say, that there would be a big increase in heroin users, for obvious reasons. If you're giving it out free, loads more people will try it, surely, they thought. And the other was that maybe it'll just stay steady. What actually happened was that the number of new heroin addicts significantly fell. And it's not totally clear why, but there's two possible explanations. I think they're probably both true. One is that it just deglamorized it, right? It's no longer a rebellion. It's actually quite a boring thing that you go to the doctor and you get it. But the second reason is even more interesting. It was discovered by an academic called Russell Newcomb. The best way to explain it is, under prohibition, if you're a heroin addict, unless you're like a, you know, you've inherited loads of money or something, you've basically got three options for how to get your heroin. If you're a woman, you can prostitute yourself. If you're a man, you can commit property crime. Or the third option, which is by far the least unpleasant, is you can be a dealer. So you can get your drugs by selling drugs to other people. In that situation, you've obviously got a strong motivation to persuade other people to try and use heroin because it's how you get your own fix, right? The way Russell Newcomb explains it is, under prohibition, heroin is like a kind of pyramid scheme, where there's a huge incentive for heroin addicts to spread heroin addiction because that's how they get their next fix. When you have prescription, obviously that just goes away. The pyramid effect goes away because there's no incentive to persuade anyone else because you've got yours from the doctor. And that seems to be why there's such a significant fall in new heroin addicts when you prescribe.
Yes, it's amazing. What do you think the innate drive to intoxicate is all about? I mean, many of us may have heard about the elephants that wait around for the fermented fruit so they get a little high, and other animals as well. And, of course, the rat park experiment was quite successful and showed a lot of things. But there is an innate drive to intoxicate. And I'm just wondering, through all of your research, what you feel that is about.
I think there's two very different things here that we need to kind of separate out. I think this is hugely important, what you're asking about. So there's intoxication and there's addiction, which are very different phenomena. Intoxication is an innate human desire. There has never been a human society anywhere in the world where people have not sought out intoxicants. The only people who didn't have any intoxicants in their natural environment were the poor Inuit, the Eskimos, and they would starve themselves to get a different head state. That's how deeply imbued in human nature it is to seek out a different way of feeling. If you think about little kids spinning round and round and round even to make themselves dizzy, even though they know it'll make them feel a bit sick, that's the first manifestation of what several kind of academics call the intoxication impulse. This is really deep in humanity. You know, every human society that has ever existed has sought out intoxicants. It seems to be quite deep in our nature. There's a big debate about why that is, and I don't really feel qualified to talk about why. Well, scientists have not, they don't know. There's lots of different theories. So there's that, there's the intoxication, and what's very striking is there's this thing called the UN Office of Drug Control, who are the main drug war body in the whole world. They are really militant drug war people. Their slogan is, a drug-free world, we can do it. And they admitted a few years ago, it was very striking, if you said to people, what proportion of drug use is non-problematic? So currently banned drug use, what proportion of it doesn't lead to any health problems, doesn't lead to addiction, doesn't lead to anyone being screwed up? The figure that this main drug war body admitted is that 90% of all existing illegal drug use is non-problematic, which is, even for someone like me, was pretty shocking, actually, because obviously the reality I've seen in my life has been mostly my addicted people. It was very striking. So we should bear in mind that what you're talking about, ordinary intoxication, the vast majority of normal drug use is like that. And that's true even for drugs that we think of as hard drugs. Only small minorities of any drug lead to addiction, which really surprised me. Although it fits with what we think. When we think about alcohol, we all know alcohol is a really potent drug. If anyone listening to this goes to a bar tonight, they'll know that the vast majority of people in that bar will not be alcoholics. And they'll know that the vast majority of people in that bar, even the people drinking vodka, then most of them are not going to be alcoholics. That's actually true of all drug use. It's just that with alcohol, we see people around us using alcohol and they'll talk about it. Someone might say on Facebook, oh, I had a great bottle of wine last night. No one, unless they're very foolish, is going to say on Facebook, oh, I had a great line of coke last night, because, well, they could be contacted by the police, they could lose their job, certainly their colleagues would talk about it. It would just be a very bad idea. So the reality of ordinary drug use, we just never hear about. It happens, you know, in the shadows, and we end up, it means that the drug war ends up creating this quite distorted picture. Now, that's not to say that the second bit of this picture, addiction is an absolute tragedy, and the thing, and it can be dealt with, and the thing that most surprised me in the research for the book was looking at what the evidence about some of the biggest causes of addiction, which I barely knew anything about, even though I had had addiction in my family. If you'd said to me 4 years ago, what causes, say, heroin addiction, I would have looked at you like you were a little bit simple-minded, and I would have said, well, heroin causes heroin addiction. We've been told a story for 100 years where it's just become our common sense. We think that if you and me and the next 20 people to walk past your door all used heroin together, by day 21, we would all be heroin addicts, because there are chemical hooks in the heroin that our body would start to physically need, and that's what addiction is. First thing that alerted me to the fact there may be something that's not right about that story is when it was explained to me, if you or me step out today after this interview and we're hit by a car, and you or me break our hips, we'll be taken to hospital, and it's quite likely we'll be given a lot of diamorphine. Diamorphine is heroin. It's much more potent heroin than you'd ever buy on the streets, because it's medically pure. It's not got the contaminants that drug dealers put in it. And you'll be given that diamorphine for quite a long time. Anyone listening to this, anywhere in America, people near you are being given very powerful heroin in hospital for quite a long period of time. What we believe about addiction is right. Those people should leave hospital as addicts, or at least some of them should. There's very detailed studies of this. It doesn't happen. They don't become addicted. And when I learned that, I thought, well, that's just so weird. I didn't know what to do with it. How can it be that, you know, the drug causes addiction in some people but not in others? Why would that be? I didn't understand it until I met a guy called Professor Bruce Alexander in Vancouver, who explained to me, the idea of addiction that we have comes from a series of experiments that were done earlier in the 20th century. They're really simple experiments. Anyone listening to this can do them at home if they're feeling a little bit sadistic. You get a rat and you put it in a cage and you give it two water bottles. One is just water and one is water laced with either heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will almost always prefer the drugged water and will almost always kill itself. So there you go. That's our theory of addiction. But Bruce comes along in the 70s and says, hang on a minute, we're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do except use these drugs. Let's do this differently. So Bruce built Rat Park. Rat Park is like heaven for rats. Everything a rat could want, it's got in Rat Park. It's got cheese, it's got colored balls, it's got tunnels, it's got loads of friends, it can have loads of sex, everything a rat wants. And they've got both the water bottles, the drugged water and the normal water. But the fascinating thing is, in Rat Park, they don't like the drugged water. They hardly ever use it. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdose. There's a really interesting human example of this that I can tell you about in a second. But what Bruce says is, this shows that both the right-wing and left-wing theories of addiction are wrong. The right-wing theory is that it's a moral failing. You're a hedonist, you party too hard, you indulge yourself. The left-wing theory is it kind of hijacks your brain, it takes you over, you become kind of a slave. Bruce says, it's not your morality, it's not your brain. Addiction, to a much larger degree than we've understood till now, is an adaptation to your environment. Human beings have an innate need to bond and connect. And when we're healthy and happy, we will bond and connect with each other. When you can't do that because you're isolated or traumatized, or life has just beaten you down, you will bond with something that gives you some sense of relief. Now, that might be gambling, that might be pornography, that might be cocaine, but it will be something.
Johan, has your personal reason for writing Chasing the Scream been satiated and soothed and satisfied?
That's a good question. No one's asked me that. That's interesting.
And I would guess that your reasons why you wrote this book became ever more evident the further you went along.
Yeah, that's a really astute question. I've not been asked that before. I think so. I think learning about what really causes addiction, and also, I guess, going to the place that's dealt with addiction in the most interesting way helped me to think differently when I came back in a way that I can tell you. So, Portugal, in the year 2000, Portugal had one of the worst drug problems in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, which is kind of mind-blowing. And one day, basically every year they tried the American way more and more. They arrested more people, imprisoned more people, and every year the problem got worse. And one day the prime minister and the leader of the opposition got together and they basically said, look, we can't go on like this. So they decided to set up a panel of scientists and doctors and said to them, basically, go away and figure out what would genuinely solve this problem. And we will agree in advance to do whatever you recommend. So it just took it out of politics. And the panel goes away, and it came back, and it said, after looking at all the evidence, it said, decriminalize all drugs, from cannabis to crack. But, and this is the crucial next step, take all the money we currently spend on arresting, harassing, imprisoning drug users, and spend it all on reconnecting drug addicts with society. It's basically the lesson of Rat Park. And that's not really what we think of as drug treatment in Britain and America. They do things like residential rehab and psychological support, and that does have real value. But actually, the biggest part of the program, and the most successful, was subsidized jobs for addicts and small loans for addicts to set up businesses. The goal was to make sure that every addict in Portugal had something to wake up for in the morning that was worthwhile. So, for example, say you used to be a mechanic. When you're ready, they'll go to a garage and they'll say, if you employ this guy as a mechanic, we'll pay half his wages for a year. So it was to make sure that they all had something to get up before in the morning, the exact opposite of what we do, where we cut people off. Something you think about Billie Holiday, we cut people off from sources of meaning. It's been now, nearly 15 years, and the results are in, and they're quite striking. Injecting drug use is down in Portugal by 50%, 50%. Overall addiction is down, overdose is massively down, HIV transmission through injecting drug use is massively down. And one of the ways you know it's been successful, actually one of the most moving interviews I did, was when I went to interview this guy called Joao Figueira, who led the opposition to the decriminalization. He was the top drug cop in Portugal. And he said what a lot of your listeners will totally understandably be thinking as they hear me say this, which is, surely if you decriminalize all drugs, you'll have like a disaster. You'll have all sorts of problems. And he said to me, I'm paraphrasing the exact words are in the book, but he said to me, everything I said would happen didn't happen. And everything the other side said would happen did. And he talked about how he felt ashamed that he'd spent 20 years arresting and harassing drug users, and he hoped the whole world followed Portugal's example. And it helped me with the people in my life to know that, because one of the things we're primed to do with addicts, if you think about that TV show that I've come to really despise, Intervention, which some of your listeners might not have seen, it's a show where basically family members of addicts who are in a bad way because it's very hard to love an addict consistently, are kind of encouraged to basically get the addict, and everyone in his or her life sits them down and says, right, you're going to rehab, and if you don't go, we're going to throw you out and cut you off. And they go to rehab for like a month, and then they come back. And almost all of them, although the TV show doesn't tell you this, because rehab has just residential rehab where you go away and then just come back and your life is how it was before, doesn't work, has terrible success rates. So you set up this addict to fail, you threaten. And one thing that really helped me was to know that actually if addiction is caused by disconnection, threatening to cut people off and disconnecting them even more is really not the answer. So the thing that I resolved to do with the addicts in my life was to say that I, to just say to them that I love them whether they're clean or whether they're not, that I will always, and I won't always be able to do this, but I will always try to come and sit with them and to try to strengthen my connection and bond with them rather than make it conditional, rather than make it precarious. And I can't tell you that's easy, and I can't, in response to a question before, I can't tell you it's resolved their problem, because it hasn't. One of my relatives is a lot better, and someone I had a relationship with is not better. But what I can say is I feel now I have a way of trying to mediate and understand how to help them. And that's that I feel is backed by really strong evidence and now an understanding of addiction and what really causes it and the biggest drivers of it. And I think that's a really that's really interesting what you asked. And I think to some degree for myself, and of course I still have doubts and I have moments of anger and I have it's not a neat anyone. I always wary of anyone who, particularly, you know, you read these addiction memoirs and then the people go, and now I'm all fine, and you kind of think, I'm sure you're not, you know, like I'm sure you're better, but I'm wary of neat solutions. Anyone who's offering neat solutions always sounds to me a bit like a drug warrior. You know, there's this great quote from Harriet Anslinger, the guy who stalked Billie Holiday and the guy who launches the drug war, where someone argues with him and he said, I've made up my mind, don't try to confuse me with the facts, which I think should be like the kind of epitaph for the entire drug war and how lots of us think about that.
Or
I don't think
we
should ever make
sticker.
Up our minds about this question. I think it's incredibly complicated. But I do think some of these findings and ideas will help us to navigate our way through it.
Johann Hari, Chasing the Scream. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, sign up for programming, leave us your comments and your thoughts, tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is at Tributaries Radio on iTunes. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.